Amiga, te tengo tremendo cuento. If you switch to AT&T, you can get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Note 5 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone.
Why are you whispering so much? What are you talking about?
Great news. Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits.
What?
Oh, Norma, did you hear? $300 in credits when you switch to AT&T.
Switch to AT&T and get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Note 5 on AT&T Next and trade in a smartphone. AT&T, mobilizing your world. Limited time offers. Requires port-in eligible service and trade-in. Get $100 bill credit applied within 90 days and $200 trade-in credit, which may be a promotion card. Fees, other charges, and restrictions apply. See store or att.com/summerbuyback for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is syndicated columnist Amy Alcon with Advice Goddess Radio. Nerd your way to a better life with the best brains in science. Now, there's that saying, the truth will set you free, and the truth is, it'll sometimes set you freer than you'd like. I was driving home today, and I was talking to my boyfriend on the phone, and we were talking and talking, and finally he told me the truth, which was that the Lakers were on, and it was the third quarter, and he really would rather be watching the Lakers than talking to me at that moment. So we have a good thing, so I just laughed, but I was thinking, maybe it's better to lie about that and say, you know, you need to go out and check the porch for intruders, you know, rather than telling the truth. And that made me think of tonight's show, which is on what huge liars we all are. Or to put it more delicately, this is a show on a fascinating topic, deception and self-deception, and we are with one of the rock stars of anthropology, Rutgers anthropology professor, Dr. Robert Trivers. He is the author of a terrific book I just quoted from in my column, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Deception in Human Life. And just to say a little more about him, his work on altruism was a huge influence in my book, I See Rude People. And when I say that he's one of the rock stars of anthropology, if I had to say which rock star, it would be Mick Jagger, because I've eaten up his work for years, and because in 2007 he won the Crayford Prize, a little thing that comes with a $500,000 check for his quote-unquote fundamental analysis of social evolution, conflict, and cooperation. Hello, Robert Trivers.
Hello.
So, now, you write in your book that deception is really all around us, you know, like the culture of fungos,
birds do it.
So and even viruses practice deception.
Yes, indeed. Deception is found at all levels of life and in all relationships. So, for example, there are bacteria that are well known to mimic our body parts in order to fool the immune system into not recognizing them. Or, since you mentioned viruses, what about HIV? What HIV does is to change its coat pattern at a fairly rapid rate so that you can never mount a good defense against it, nor can we easily come up with an immunization for the same reason. And by the way, this constantly changing its coat pattern so as to stay one step ahead of the immune system reminds me of octopuses and squids, which are the masters of camouflage in nature. They have a very unusual feature where each cell of color is innervated by a single nerve that stretches quite a distance. So literally an octopus can change its coat pattern in about 2 seconds. And what they usually they're matching the background very closely, but if they happen to be away from the background, what they will then do is rifle through a series of phenotypes, that is a series of appearances, at a rate of like one every 3 seconds. It's like they have a deck of 60 cards, 60 images of themselves. It's like analogous to the coat proteins on viruses. And so whenever the predator thinks he or she spots the damn octopus, it's gone and changed to a different camouflage pattern. So yes, indeed, in predator-prey relations, which we're talking about right now, or host-parasite relations, or, as you well know, when you get within species, it's not just ourselves, but a whole host of species that practice deception towards members of their own species.
Well, your book, The Folly of Fools, talks about all this, the parasites and all the different forms of nature that practice deception, but you mainly talk about us, how we evolved to be liars, and how in order to lie better to others, we often lie to ourselves first.
Yes, indeed, Amy. I'm glad you brought up that point, because the benefits of deception are pretty obvious. Like, let's use a human example. I can tell you as your mate that you're the one and only for me, and God Almighty, I don't think of anybody else. But actually, I have a child down the street by someone else, or even by the maid that works in our home, okay? Likewise, the wife could tell the husband that she loves him to the end of the earth and all these children are his, but one of them is by the next-door neighbor. So in both those cases, you have selection for strong deception. That is, there are real benefits directly here measured in terms of surviving offspring, which, as you know, is the ultimate measure of benefits in an evolutionary argument. Those genes that are associated with more offspring, by definition, become more numerous. So here, the woman, if she's lying to her husband, she's fooling him about a child, and likewise, vice versa. As long as they're not detected, they gain a benefit. So there's no real problem explaining it, but self-deception has been a puzzle in human thought ever since we've been writing down words, at least 2,000 to 4,000 years, back to religious writings and so on. And it's been a deep puzzle to figure out why on earth would we deceive ourselves? We are both victim and victimizer. If I take $10 off of you, Amy, and you don't detect it, you're $10 short and I'm $10 richer. But where's the profit in removing $10 from my left pocket and sticking it in my right pocket, so to speak? How do we get this phenomenon to fly? And that was a problem I faced back in the 70s because it was very counterintuitive if you were into evolutionary logic. And way back then, when I was working on parent-offspring conflict, I saw that, if you link self-deception to deception of others, then it can give an advantage. Because if I'm lying to you now about something you care about or members of your audience care about, and better yet, you're close at hand and know something about me, then you can watch for the cues of consciously mediated deception. For example, it is well known now, and for a very simple reason, that one of the better cues to conscious deception is a rise in the pitch of our voice, especially as we come to the key word. And the reason is it because we naturally tense up. This is a situation where I've got to slip it by you. And by tensing up, we naturally tend to elevate our voice. Now, I could fight that in theory by saying, all right, here comes the key voice. Now relax your midriff. Keep your voice low. But that would take an awful lot of cognitive resources. It'd be very hard to pull off. But if I'm unconscious of the deception, if I practice self-deception, that is kept from my conscious mind what the truth is, then I may still get detected, but not off of you picking up the cues of consciously mediated deception.
So we believe the lie. We believe the lie, and that helps better promote
the billboard. We believe the lie, or doubting it never occurs to us. It's unconsciously generated as a truth, and yes, we present it as a truth. We're conscious of no other alternative.
Now, just to backtrack a little bit, and we will get into this fascinating stuff in your book, The Folly of Fools, on detecting lies, the myths
yes.
that people believe about lie detection and what the real things are. But I wanted to just ask you, we all know what deception is, but I think self-deception is one of those things we all think we know, but we don't quite. So how do you define self-deception?
Well, that's a very good question, and let me just step one step backward and say that philosophers have tied themselves into knots needlessly over the problem by saying, how can the self deceive the self? That's a contradiction in terms, so it doesn't exist. So you bypass that problem by simply defining the self as the conscious mind, what we're consciously aware of, and the rest of us, which is the unconscious mind, the unconscious body, is what we're not aware of. So self-deception is really when the rest of the organism is keeping our conscious mind in the dark. Now, I used to think, because of certain powerful experiments that were run in the 70s, the very first on self-deception, that proved that that the truth was stored in the unconscious but the falsehood in the conscious, I used to think the truth was always stored somewhere, but no, I don't think so anymore. I think there are a number of situations in which we, you know, turn away from even engaging in reality or being exposed to reality, or, if you'll forgive me in that memorable phrase you ran by me a while ago, we can sleepwalk through a field of facts. That is, not even be consciously attuned to pick up the information. So a trivial example of that, I hope it's not too revealing, but we are out in California, aren't we? If there's another article on the dangers of tobacco, I never look at it. That's established 30 or 40 years ago, and I haven't had a cigarette in 10 years. But if there's an article on the health benefits of marijuana, I'll read it carefully. If there's one on the hazards of marijuana, I'll look at it, but trust me, in a critical spirit, you know, all scientific gear is turned to reject it or find out where the flaw in it. So self-deception is keeping the conscious mind in the dark, but it can happen in a variety of ways. One is to shunt the truth into the conscious mind, and create a false in the conscious mind. Another is to never allow the truth in the first place. Have biased systems of picking up information, have biased systems of storing them, and very certainly biased systems of remembering them.
Well, here's a question, because you write that our sensory systems are designed to give us an accurate picture of what's before us. When I'm driving, I don't see a big purple gorilla in the street. I see the street in the street. But yet, you know, in this deception, self-deception, there's this bias and distortion. How does that happen in this one area?
What do you mean in this one area?
Well, in this one area, that I'm not hallucinating all sorts of things, but I can see things in a biased, distorted way.
There's no social dimension there, Amy. There's no advantage to you. So you hallucinate a gorilla when you're driving. That's a dreadful cognitive error on your part. But if you hallucinate that you're somewhat better looking than you really are in a social interaction with multiple people, if you carry yourself a bit more confidently than the facts warrant, and if that in turn influences other people in a positive way, then you can get the feedback. So no, I tie it very tightly, or as tightly as I can, to our social interactions with other people, and where and when deception is valuable, and where and when self-deception supports it.
Self-deception and self-interest seem extremely well tied together.
Well, I like that, but yeah.
And actually, I don't know if this counts as deception. I have a terrible memory, and I tend to forget bad things that have happened to me, and so I'm happier because of that. It's sort of like a rabbit hole that facts go down.
That's a very interesting phenomenon, and I certainly agree with you, Amy, that we have a bias, and we recognize it. You know, a negative thought bubbles up, and we swat it back down, you know. Indeed, they've, well, never mind that. They've done some neurophysiology on what they call directed forgetting, you know. But, we have to draw limits to that. As I point out in the chapter on the immunology of self-deception, which was a real eye-opener for me. I didn't know nothing about that when I started writing the final draft of this book 5 years ago, you know. But I soon discovered that there were immunological correlates of self-deception or lack of self-knowledge and immunological improvement associated with getting deeper insight into yourself. And also,
can you give an example, just an example, because that was a fascinating chapter.
Yes, let me give you the straight example, and then let me give you an application to daily life. Okay, the experiment was that caught everybody's attention roughly 1997. Jamie Pennebaker at the University of Texas, brilliant social psychologist. Sorry, he does the following thing: he brings adults into the lab and he asks them to tell the investigator, you know, in private sessions, what the most traumatic thing in their life was. And they're asked to cogitate on it for a while and write a little bit on it. You know, just think about it, okay? Now, sometimes, in the worst case, it's sexual trauma early in life. That has the worst effects throughout life because that's the least shared, by the way, which we could come back to. But never mind, it can be the divorce of your parents, whatever the hell it was. What's the most traumatic? Now he splits them into two, and one group, he has them write for 20 minutes for the next 3 days in a private journal, this is not to be shared, about their trauma. The other group writes about what they did that day. All right, what happens is that those that are writing about their trauma, their mood goes down, exactly the phenomenon you're talking about. You know,
right.
We don't like to think about it. It makes us feel worse. Their mood goes down, but their immune system, as measured by a simple oral assay, immediately starts improving, getting stronger. And 3 months later, here's the key, our immune system is still elevated, and now our mood is better. So now our mood has, meanwhile, the people writing about what they did that way, they're just flatlining. You know, they're not changing at all. Now, he then pursued this by saying, you know, what are the verbal characteristics of sharing, your trauma to yourself that are conducive to immune improvement, and what are the ones that aren't? Because there's, of course, variability. Some people improve quite a bit, some people don't. So he then invented the analysis of language, and he's perfected that, and he's written a beautiful book on the secret life of pronouns. But as applied to trauma, he showed things like if you took alternative vantage points in describing it about describing it, you were more likely to improve. So you didn't just say I. You say I sometimes and they sometimes, and you understand you're taking alternative viewpoints.
Yes.
Insight words, so defined, were associated with improvement, and so on. So anyway, this is the other side of not facing reality. Yes, not facing reality will give us an immediate boost in not being depressed, and that has a social dimension. It's very important to emphasize. It's not at all clear that you're not also keeping up a face of being happier. You know what I mean? You are happier, but you're also projecting it more. But in any case, let me give you a dramatic application of this kind of logic to the phenomenon of gay men and the degree to which they are out of the closet. And I think we all know what that is now. If you're in the closet, you're leading a life of kind of public denial and sometimes having to play a double role where you switch genders when you're talking about your loved one and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And the more you're in the closet, the less heterosexual people you're sharing your identity with. All right, fine. Now, homosexual men have been unusually well studied scientifically because of their interaction with HIV. So the first work was done on HIV positive men, and it showed, lo and behold, that if you are, the more you are out of the closet, the more you are out of the closet, the healthier you are. And if you divide them into half, the people that are out of the closet live 20% longer than those in the closet. So living this kind of lie socially and internally as well, there's self-deception going on, plus there's deception of others, is immunologically costly. Now, yeah. It's not limited to HIV positive. They did work on HIV negative men, and they showed that, again, if you're in the closet, you suffer more cancer on the one extreme or bronchitis on the other. So this immune dimension to life is very important to be aware of, even though we're only at the start of understanding it.
What are some of the other costs? Are there other major costs that self-deception has for us?
Oh, I think so. And I, you know, one of the failings of my book was that I didn't sit down and, you know, write out a table of all the costs and use that to guide a discussion. I feel bad about that. I mentioned.
No, it's a great book. You know, I
well, bless you.
But I like that you're not self-deceived about that.
Well, bless you. There are lots of costs. You know, we're out of touch with reality. So let me give you two kinds of costs. You know, when we're well self-deceived, we're more easily manipulated by others. Con artists, for example, are professionals at inducing self-deception and then guiding you around by your nose until they extract the cost.
Well, wait, let me just understand that. So people who are more... practice more self-deception are more easily conned?
Yes, because they'll be unconscious of what's going on around them, and if the other person is conscious, then that person has an advantage. You know, I tell the memorable story in my book, and I'll just condense it down to three lines here. This fool walks into a country bar in Jamaica. This is 40 years ago. No electricity. This was our entertainment for the night. And claims that he was from Kingston, and he was claiming you cannot make a Kingston man drunk. And the locals are arguing with him until suddenly one of the locals has the idea, bright idea of switching sides and buying him a drink. So he says, no, you cannot make a Kingstonian drunk, and buys a guy a drink. Suddenly all of us caught on, you know. No signal was passed between us. Nobody said anything. We all switch now. So he's hearing a chorus of people saying that you cannot make a Kingstonian drunk while we buy him drink after drink. The guy does everything. He falls off his stool. He vomits. He slips and falls in his vomit. I mean, it was dreadful, but I'm telling you, I'm not telling you with pride or urging on others, but we were weeping with laughter. You know, it took us like 2.5 hours to create this disaster. When I told Huey Newton the story, he said, you could have killed him. You owned him. So you see, it wasn't really that he believed, he could not really believe that you couldn't get a Kingston man drunk, for Christ's sake. He lived in Kingston. But he's out there bragging, and he thinks he's fooled us. And he ends up being the only unconscious one in the room, you see?
Right.
The guy that switched sides suddenly made us all conscious of the fact that we could F over this guy now using his self-deception against him, you know.
Right, so people can play on this. And you also wrote about something else. You're using the term boops, you know, about a situation in Jamaica that was fascinating.
Yes. Yes, well, these are older men. These are older men who are entranced by younger women, and the most successful boops is one that you don't even give any sex to because you keep him on a leash of anticipation. And that guy will buy you a car, that guy will set you up in a small home, you know, if he has the resources. So keeping a boops is keeping an older man investing overly much in you through, in that case, vague promises of sexual congress. You know, in the more direct case, you're giving him a little bit of sex, but pretty damn unfrequently, you know. Pretty
right, and of course, this is a feature in every society, not just Jamaica. And I better do a station ID because I have not wanted to stop you. So this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the help of the top brains in science. Tonight's brain belongs to Dr. Robert Trivers, who is author of The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Deception in Human Life, which is a book I have referenced in my column and highly recommend. If you'd like to call in to comment, to ask for advice, or to ask a question, the number is 347-326-9761. That's 347-326-9761. Now, you were just talking also about self-confidence, displays of false self-confidence, and I'm reminded that this probably goes back into our animal past, and there I read some signaling theory about the hyena and how the hyenas, you know, they chase the gazelles, but that some of the gazelles, you know, the really strong ones, instead of just bolting when they see a hyena, they do this thing called stodding, where they jump up and down in place, like to say, look, I'm so strong, I'm going to have a cappuccino and a cigarette, and then when I'm done, I'll run. So, you know, is there an example, you know, where humans do this thing? I think that the guy in Jamaica, the drunk guy, that was an example. You know, do you have other examples of this? And why, how does that benefit us?
Well, I'm delighted to have you mention it, and you have it exactly right from the get-go. In my opinion, this is one of our deeper forms of self-deception, that is reaching deepest into our animal past, or reaching quite a ways back there. And it's perhaps extra dangerous for that reason, overconfidence. And often when you don't know what the hell you're doing, you know, it's even worse if you're dealing with international relations or launching a war 10,000 miles away. Basically, you don't know what the hell you're doing. So there, overconfidence can play a really deadly role. But leaving aside that kind of mega effect, here's why I think it goes way back. First of all, male-male interactions primarily, but any kind of aggressive interactions, females, as in hyenas, fight even more than males. So we both have this tendency, but more strongly in males, in my opinion, to square off in fights over evolutionary time. And there, the other organism's evaluation of its own competence, as measured by its apparent self-confidence, is a relevant fact. He's known himself all his life. You're just meeting him, so to speak. Likewise, in courtship situations, which has mostly been males trying to court females because they're the ones doing all the work, and the males want sexual access to spread their genes, and she wants good genes. So again, a female is going to be evaluating a male partly in terms of his own self-image. And there I do think of something that I think is true in human life. I don't know whether you would agree or not, Amy, but to me, one of the most reliable sexual turnoffs or romantic turnoffs is when someone has a low self-image, you know. It's like you meet a woman, I'm thinking back when I was 30 and she's 25 and she has a low image and you're saying, well, I've only known her for 2 days, but she's known herself for 25 years, so she must know something I don't know. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, I absolutely agree with you. And actually, I'd love to have you sort of diagnose whether you think this is a good idea. I had therapist Robert Glover on another show, and he wrote a great book called No More Mr. Nice Guy that basically helps two nice guys. You know, they call themselves nice guys, but they're really two nice guys. They're big suck-ups. You know, he helps them sort of recover from that, but actually by having personal integrity and stuff, not by like the pickup artist where you come up with, you know, sort of tactics to fool women. But he said, you know, as you're shy and you're working on it, I'm obsessed with cheating and not asking women out. So go up to women and tell them as an opener something like, I don't usually come talk to women because I'm shy, but I couldn't help talking to you. So it's very honest and it's sort of confident, it seems. Do you approve of that method or you think that that's maybe not that workable?
No, the particular suggestion you make I think is creative, you know. And I've been in that situation. I mean, all of us have, well, I don't know about all of us. I've certainly been in situations where I've lacked for an elementary line of approach that was plausible, you know. And maybe I do think the older I've gotten, the more, you know, I'm up to less, first of all, which takes some of the pressure off it. But I do think I've learned more, you know, a line where you could approach a woman in a natural way. But so, yeah, I like that. I'm just hearing the particular line you suggested as a way of overcoming lack of self-confidence. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it's sort of lack of self-confidence put out as confidence, which I thought was a kind of amazing twist.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I think owning up to your own deficiency, if it's not too grotesque, can be disarming, you know.
Yeah, because
well, I may
expect-
not be the best-looking man in the world. You're certainly one of the better-looking women. Well, no, I'm probably messing up already. we won't try to improve on these lines.
Well, I think it's unexpected, and I think that people expect you to try to, you know, hide your shyness, and so when you're open about something, I think that that's a very interesting tactic, as opposed to trying to deceive about it.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there's two, you know, this cost of self-deception. Okay, where is it most registered in my life? I'll be honest with you, if you go to the end of chapter 5, and you read about the pain of betrayal, and you read about the pain of public shaming. You know, I'm talking about something that happened to me within the last 5 years, you know. And one thing that was true was I was working on this book, and I wasn't paying enough attention to this woman, you know. And
yeah,
they will leave you if you're not paying them enough attention.
We do that, we girls. We like
you,
to be paid
attention.
You
girls do
to
that,
it.
And you got every reason to, you know. But then that's a mistake, but the self-deception was not facing the reality as it was happening. I keep denying to myself what, after the disaster occurred, were obvious signals that if I had half a brain screwed on tightly, I would have been saying, hey, Robert, this don't add up. I'll give you one example. I'm in Europe.
Yes.
I take the woman to Greece, to Athens, at Christmas time. She doesn't buy me a Christmas present. Now, come on. If
right,
alarm bells don't go off, I was furious.
Right. Okay, so but alarm bells did go off.
Well, but they went off in the wrong way. I was furious, but not warned. I'm telling you, if you watched my subsequent behavior over the next 6 months, you know, I didn't give much weight to that. I forgave her for it, you know, as if it was a trivial fact. But there were, meanwhile, other facts piling up. So now, when I make the calculus in my own life backwards, I say to myself, all right, were you just deciding to go all out and produce this damn book, and if you had to fantasize a non-existent relationship to keep yourself balanced, you know, you were going to do it and then suffer the cost later? I don't know. The cost was brutal.
Well, what's really interesting, though, about your book, that I read your book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Self-Deception in Human Life. Oh, and I should do a little station ID. I'm talking with Dr. Robert Trivers, author of The Folly of Fools, and we're talking about why we humans are such lying mofos and how to lie less to yourself and how you can maybe catch other people in their lies and their whoppers. But so I'm reading your book, and I have all these things that are very helpful to me where, okay, I have to look for that, notice that. And you keep saying throughout your book that you sort of don't learn. You're a guy, you know, you've studied this, you've written about it, you're the guy on this topic, and you don't seem to learn from your mistakes. And why not?
I don't know. If there's some of you out there that are learning from your mistakes, please, you know, write me immediately at trivers.rci.rutgers.edu. I mean, I give excuses in the book as if it's a general failing, okay? So I do talk about, I mean, you could even call it genetic determinism, or just the fact that I will repeat the same God Jesus error over and over and over again. I can give you chapter and verse after the fact. I can diagram it till you drop dead out of boredom.
Well, my favorite one, I think, was the one where you would be thinking about something, you'd be preoccupied, and you break things. You break glasses, you break door handles, and you finally, it seems like that's the one thing you learned to stop doing. And why did you learn to stop doing that?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No, that was the one. That was the one. You know, the major improvement I've had. And so I was just finishing saying that, you know, I can talk about the past, but it doesn't allow me to predict, i.e. prevent, the future. Now, the one example you're giving is the only one I've learned of any consequence, and that is when you mess up an ongoing life, and you gave the example of breaking a wine glass while you're washing the dishes, or tripping and falling in certain situations, or I yanked the handle off my Toyota Corolla. I didn't know they were made out of plastic. I have half a door handle now, and I have for, you know, like 9 months. So whenever something like that happens, I immediately look at myself and I say, what were you thinking just then? And often it's hostile, so I took off nearly half my lower lip shaving one morning while calling someone a mofo, a term you just used. And I thought afterwards, I said, well, he really is a mofo because he's 700 miles away and he's managed to cut nearly half my lower lip off, right? So often I say, look, you're screwing up in daily life, so what you were contemplating doing, which is usually calling him up on the phone and calling him that, or in one case when I broke a wine glass, it was calling a woman and telling her something she didn't need to hear and wouldn't be happy to hear, you know. So all it was going to do was going to create negative vibrations, some of which were going to reach me in return, right? So the one thing I learn is look, if you're screwing up in daily life, maybe your thought processes are screwed up at the same time. Now, it's not just anger. In the case of the door handle, it was overexcitement that if I wrote this guy, this key geneticist, an email, that I would get this position I wanted. So I'm sort of writing the email in my head and about to send it that night when I yank off the door handle. So then I say to myself, wait a second. Calm down and think about the sucker for 3 days, you know. Now, by the way, I still didn't get nothing out of it in that case. But that's where there was one situation. It took me three different times. Twice I did something, you know, including breaking a wine glass, and nothing was in my brain. And then I dropped my computer, and I suddenly spotted her, and she was the editor for the previous publisher, and she was so hostile to my book, and I was having to rewrite it a second time. Eventually, I had to switch publishers because she was stark crazy on it. But I realized that I had been slowing down the finishing of my book out of fear of their response. I don't know whether you've ever been in that situation where you're unaware of the fact that you are slowing down your work because you're afraid of the likely response. So once I spotted that, again, by watching my screw-ups in daily behavior, I switched immediately. Next morning, I said, all right, you're going to finish by October. And whenever I felt my spirits lagging, I would cuss her out and call her a mofo, this and that.
I find that very helpful. I do this a lot in my life. I look at how was I a jerk this week, and so how can I be less of a jerk next week? And I find the dishonesty that people have is really, their self-deception is really, really hampers them. And I know that we're self-deceiving creatures, and so I look for that in myself, and I find that, you know, of course, I'm going to still be deceiving myself in some ways, but I can catch more things, you know, through that process and not behave like such a jerk in the future.
Well, bless you. I'm sure you're pulling it off, and maybe I do it a little bit more than I'm aware of.
But you might also be deceiving yourself in that thinking that you do it poorly when maybe you do it better than you do. So.
Yes, exactly. I may be a little bit unconscious of it, because when you talk about, you know, the way, I mean, you talk about it to yourself slightly differently than I do. I don't make a vow to improve myself. There's sometimes when I pray and I meditate, it very much has to do with trying to improve myself. And I don't believe in, you know, I don't believe in a whole bunch of prayer that, you know, you can pray and help someone who's in the hospital and all that kind of nonsense. But if you want to meditate and pray to improve yourself, and especially if, you know, if you feel like you messed up bad, yeah, I do think being honest about one's failings, that's being honest about one's past. And one benefit is if you've harmed others and you're conscious and honest, then you're much more apt to say a word of apology, or, you know what I mean?
Right. If you look for that. If you look
as well as do it less often. And I think you're probably right about that. If you're more honest about it, you're going to do it less often and not even notice it, maybe.
Right, and that's what your book helped me with is it just reminded me to look. It reminded me that we're all self-deceiving. And I should say, this is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the Top Brains in Science. And tonight's brain belongs to Dr. Robert Trivers, who is author of The Folly of Fools, a book I highly recommend about deceit and deception in human life, self-deceit especially, and self-deception. And I've quoted from this book in my column, and I highly recommend it. I wanted to get into something I loved in your book. And first we should get into what is cognitive load before we get into – I want to get into how to debunk the myths that people believe about lie detection, but we should first explain cognitive load.
Well, Amy, I didn't know what cognitive load was until I learned it in the very literature you're mentioning, although as – you know, it has applications more broadly. So,
are you mentioning the literature? We talked before the show about the literature on choice, the research on choice and cognitive load.
We can come back to that.
Okay.
But, I mean, go ahead if you want to.
Well, I just wanted to explain cognitive load. You know that there is weight on your brain from making choices, and that you weigh on your brain, and you deplete your brain, you deplete your cognitive ability with all these things you do, making choices and
So let's deal with it from the ground up. One way to increase cognitive load is to make someone add numbers while they're also answering your questions.
We should just backtrack, because you were saying that lying, you wrote that lying can be very cognitively demanding. And
yeah,
so
hold on a second. Hold on a second, Amy. I'm going exactly there.
Okay.
But I'm just going through, just hold on one second. So an easy way to increase cognitive load is to increase the number of things you're having to do simultaneously with your brain. When you're talking about choice, you've got to weigh factors and so on, so it may be expensive. But here, let's say you just ask someone to add some numbers while also answering questions. This is something that Dr. Vry, who's the world's expert on interrogation and detection of deception in criminal situations, and maybe the world's expert on detection of deception in humans, he's now advising this as an adjunct to when you're questioning a witness. Instead of using this method of trying to scare the sucker into confessing, which is a very primitive way of extracting information from people and very likely to lead to false results. So anyway, what's he talking about? Why would Vry say that? For a very simple reason. Lying, especially consciously, is intrinsically behavior with high cognitive load. If you're having to think up the lie on the spot, remember, you've got to invent a falsehood that doesn't contradict anything the listener knows already or will soon find out. You have to tell it in a plausible way, and you have to remember it yourself. That's high cognitive load. So it turns out that cues that are associated with high cognitive load are better predictors of deception than things like nervousness per se and so on. So let me give you an example. We blink more often when we're nervous. But again, if you ask someone to add numbers, i.e. you increase their cognitive load, they blink less. So which do we do when we're lying? Vry's research shows that we blink less when we're lying. So instead of showing the cue that's associated with nervousness, we actually show a cue that's associated with having to think harder, so to speak. Now, let me give you another example of the same thing. He actually tested this thing. The best sample is off of Dutch interrogations, all of which have to be recorded by law and so on. So they allowed him, as a scientist, to get matched samples of innocent and guilty people being interrogated by the police. And then they had other people varying degrees of training, police officers or specialists, look at the videos and see if they could tell deceivers from non-deceivers. He showed one interesting thing right off the bat. If you ask the cops to pick out who's lying more, who's the liar and who's telling the truth, they did worse, they did better than chance, but they did better still if you simply ask them who's thinking harder. You don't mention deception at all. You just say, who's thinking harder? Let me give you another example of how this nervousness thing is not the way we thought it was. I always thought, and I used to lecture on this, that self-deception would mean that your eyes wouldn't move around nervously, you know, from side to side because you can't face the person while you're lying to them. No. The best evidence now suggests that, again, cognitive load rules. It's hard to tell a lie to someone while they're looking at you while you're looking at them. So your eyes don't move around nervously. What they do is they stare off into a fixed point in space while you invent the damn lie, and then you look back at the person in the eyes. So that's why we have this notion of the eye movements. You know, it's very specific. So cognitive load turns out to be very much associated with detection of conscious deception. And one of the things that self-deception does is it gets rid of the conscious cognitive load, you know. Our brain is already consuming 20% of resting metabolic energy. The whole time we've been talking here, a fifth of our energy and a fifth of all of your listeners' energies, unless they've been running around, i.e. if they're resting and relaxing, has been consumed by our brains. And that's happening regardless of cognitive load or whatnot. So the point is that when we're practicing self-deception unconsciously, we're saving all this conscious cognitive load, and we're not increasing the overall energy budget one bit. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very interesting.
Yes, if your unconscious mind is making up the lies for you, that saves you the energy of making them up. There are parts of your unconscious mind that can sort of sieve for relevant supporting data and so on. And also, by the way, Pennebaker's kind of verbalistic analysis shows that one of the traits of lies is that they are simpler in structure. They lack words like although. So you don't say, although it was raining hard that day, I still decided to walk to my office, which was in fact true. No, you say, I walked to the office. In other words, you keep it cognitively simple.
It's simple, so, and that's contrary to what we think, because we think that liars really embellish, and that word is always lying and embellish goes together, but so that's not true.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I never thought of that before. I mean, and that's a beautiful choice of words, embellish. I think sometimes there's some kind of lying. First of all, there's some liars that are really good at embellishing, right? They can create a whole phantasmagorical set of stories, and it's only after you've heard the sixth one you've decided this can't be true, this one organism doing all that stuff. But anyway, I do think there's something along the lines you're mentioning, embroidering and so on.
Because that seems to, the more detail you add, if you add detail to a story, that makes it believable. You know, if you tell me what color the shirt was and everything, because if you're in reality, you remember those little things. If I'm telling you a story, and again, I do not have, I joke that my mind's like a steel sieve, you know, but I could sort of slowly remember, oh, yeah, we were there, and there was a guy there with a dog, you know, and I think if you're lying, you, and you don't think to try to deceive, that maybe you don't do that, you don't embroider, you don't embellish.
Well, Amy, I'll just make a slightly different point here. I like your point a lot, but I'll make a slightly different point here, and that is we live in a world in which there's varying degrees of consciousness. So you are, I'm not blowing smoke up nowhere, relatively highly conscious on this subject. So you can already imagine the counter argument, which is you should embroider, you should make it vivid.
Right.
And I agree with you, but I hadn't thought of that separate from when I heard the evidence. Incidentally, I mean the experiments are kind of, like where, these are kind of simple experiments where you have to lie quickly and people are not planning it out well ahead of time. So they just simplify. They also use I less often. We have a natural tendency to distance ourselves from the lie, either disowning it or, like it wasn't me that did it if you're having to explain away something that was bad.
So someone's using third person. They're talking about this happened rather than I did this.
Apparently, yes. I mean, they're definitely reducing the use of the word I and so on. I'll give you, I know you said when we talked before the show started, we'd go light on politics and so on, but let me give you one striking example of how this methodologies are starting to get sophisticated in an interesting way. It's intrinsically hard to look at any historical figure, a president or a secretary of defense or anybody, and watching them testify, say, is that pure deceit or is it pure self-deception or is it what mixture of what? You just cannot say, However, people off of Pennebaker's work, what they did was very clever. They took the statements by the key people that planned and carried out this war on Iraq in 2002, and this is, Secretary of Offense or Defense, as we call it, and whoever, a vice president and so on. Now, they compiled 70 statements by these characters that were pumping WMDs or Saddam was connected to bin Laden, and they collected 70 statements by these suckers on neutral topics. Didn't have nothing to do with these lies that were being told, And lo and behold, 3 out of 4 of the criteria that Pennebaker set up were satisfied by these, suggesting conscious deception. They used I less frequently when they were talking about WMDs and bin Laden. They used these words that added detail, like although and, less often. There was another one that was in the right direction. The only one was in the wrong direction was that they used less active words. When we
what
tell
does that
a lie...
mean? Oh, go
well,
ahead.
In other words, more passive construction. When we tell a lie... Whoever is, we tend to say, I went to the office and I discovered this, or if they're using the I word, But you're active, or the other person did so and so. But they're switching to a more passive voice, less active. But we were denying that we were actively planning it, so maybe that's why active voices went down. But I don't want to get off your focus.
Oh, yeah, my focus. Because I want to go back to relationships.
Yes.
And if you had to say, is self-deception good or bad for relationships? If you had to make a decision there, what would you say?
Oh, my God, you're not easy.
That's not what the boy said in high school, but okay. sorry, couldn't resist that low humor. So is self-deception good or bad for relationships?
Well, I'm kind of feeble on it, I have a section on marriage, and I don't know what to think about it. I was thinking about it earlier today. I quote some old statement that you should go into marriage with both eyes open, and once you're in there, just keep one eye open. And I said something in a book about, my interpretation was, try to weigh the options and the reality before you commit. But once you commit, commit to the point of not, being hypercritical. Keep one eye open for self-defense.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it makes
now
you
there's,
stab.
Now there's these interesting data, Amy, which you might be able to interpret better than me. And basically the form of the data are, and they're reviewed in the chapter on sex in my book, is that happier couples or couples that are less likely to break up are more likely to rewrite past history in a positive way, but you don't know but you don't know cause and effect. And that's a major point about this whole thing, you know, is which way is cause and effect going here?
Right.
Is it that, you know, you and your boyfriend kind of agree almost without saying that you're always going to have this upwardly view of how things are going, and that keeps you on an upwardly moving trajectory? Or is it simply that you do have a good relationship, and in a good relationship there's a natural tendency, like you say, to forget the bad stuff or whatever, remember the good more, and so you see more and more good. I don't know.
Well, I would love to see a study on if people with bad memories are happier. Seriously,
yes.
Because...
Yes, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
There are people who have done things to me, and I will see... Greg and I will see them... Well, Greg's my boyfriend, and we'll...
Yeah.
And I'll remember that I don't like them anymore, but I won't remember why. And that's really annoying. And he sped me out of this place. We saw this horrible woman there. And I knew she had done something to me, but I just couldn't remember what it was.
Hey, let me ask you a question.
I got to give you a talk
in Munich, March 24th. A big conference, 200 people, the Ministry of Justice, all these law professors. It's on law and kind of consilience or compromise, or, you know, in other words, how do you get people to get together and agree on things? So that applies to marriage. And I'll give the lecture. I'm going to give it in German on deceit and self-deception, but I'm trying to think about it. And, you know, I don't know much to think about it. One, in terms of marriage and in general in relations, is if you're arguing the wrong way, then she's saying you always do this and he's saying you never do that. When both those statements are flat false on the surface, you know, The best you could say is you often do this, or you too much do this, or you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So with all your knowledge, well, let me mention one other thing that's mentioned in my book, and then I want your opinion.
Okay.
If in certain situations, if you give people a set of facts, it can drive them apart. In other words, you have people that are pro-choice or pro-whatever it is, life, whatever the hell they're calling themselves these days, or capital punishment was the actual experiment they did, and you give them a balanced set of facts about it, the people differ in these experiments more afterwards than before. It may depend on exactly how the experiments are run. It's like each one picks out the stuff that supports them, and now they're more sure they're right. So just simply putting out common information to people doesn't seem to be sufficient if you want to try to get them to compromise. So you tell
me,
you're the
expert. You have to give them, they have to have a common interest. And so in a relationship, it's don't act ever like you forgot you love each other. Things have to be our problems. And you have to emphasize with these people that you this idea where one person's going to win or another person's going to win, that's not how things work. People have to give. You give a little, they give a little. And there has to be a spirit of fairness. And I think that the arguing, the irrationality is a huge problem in human life. Like you were saying, when people use these broad statements, you never this, you never that. I'm very influenced by the late Albert Ellis, who is one of the co-founders of cognitive therapy, and he talks about rationality, and I think it's a huge, huge deal. If you can apply rationality to these situations and not speak that way, and part of it is just that if you talk to people that way and you're that demeaning and just coming from this nuclear point of view, it's already radioactive, you're already at DEFCON 7, you know, it's not going to work out well. You know, you have to go in with a spirit of fairness, with a spirit of this is our problem, we're going to throw it on the table, it's our problem. And that's where I think that couples go wrong, because they don't behave as a couple, they behave as two individuals who happen to be living under the same house and under a marriage contract. But if they
hold on one second. Okay, couples go wrong by not emphasizing couples, but two separate individuals.
Right,
okay.
By not being a team. When you have become a couple with someone, you've become a team. And so they are acting out of keeping with what they have defined themselves with. So that's a conflict. And so instead of acting as two team members who have different interests, you know, they act as two individuals at war. And this is never, never going to end well.
Well, I think you and I can unify ourselves on that.
I agree. So, you know, because in war, someone's always going to get their leg blown off if it's a war. And if it's just a mediation session where we're trying to come to something mutually agreeable, that's the problem. It is that thing. You know, people talk to each other like they don't love each other. This is really crazy because you might in that moment want to win, but you're not winning. It's that he who dies with the most toys wins, and then, you know, everybody's dead.
Yes. Well, you're beautiful. I just feel cheated that I have to live back here in the great retarded state of New Jersey, and I can't listen to you. What are you, once a week?
I'm once a week when you hear me on the radio, or I'll, you know, have you back, or if you come out here, go for these sort of nerdathon dinners with, you know, Catherine Salmon and all these people come out. It's just a bunch of nerds having dinner, and so you're totally welcome. We'd all love it if you came. It'd be really fun.
Well, God bless you. I don't know when I'm going to reach there again, but you've just given me so much insight, because I'll just translate this into German, tell the Germans this is about marriage and couples, and they can extrapolate to larger team networks.
Well,
I think it's beautiful.
Your work has been a huge influence on me, so the idea that I could be some, you know, help you is kind of cool. You know, since I'm the advice goddess, not the PhD, and I always appreciate when people.
Yeah, but I'm the PhD in need of advice, and
see, you're not self-deceiving, so I really like that.
Well, I try to keep it down to a dull roar. You know, I really don't believe in it. I believe it's evolved and is all around it, but I'm not a supporter of it.
Well, I can't wait to see what you do next. We have run out of time, so I have to do a little ending, so hang on here for a second. This is Amy Alcon's Advice Goddess Radio, Nerd Your Way to a Better Life with the help of the top brains in science, and thank you, Robert Turris, for being with us tonight. And I love your book, The Folly of Fools, The Logic of Deceit and Deception in Human Life. I recommend it. And we'll have to talk further because
God bless you and keep
very,
you.
Very
thank
interesting.
You.
Amiga, te tengo tremendo cuento. If you switch to AT&T, you can get $300 in credits when you buy a Samsung Note 5 on AT&T Next and trade in.